This is the World Cafe. I'm Rena Duris. Is there anything better than that feeling you get when you are in on a joke? Like you get something that other people don't? You're part of a special club, right? You're part of a community. For over 20 years, Tom Sharpling, along with his comedy partner, John Worster, have been making jokes and creating a community like that with The Best Show. Tom hosts the weekly radio show, which used to be on the public radio station WFMU. He answers phone calls from listeners, as well as John, who calls in as different recurring characters. It's this funny, bizarre, self-contained universe. And if you listen and you get it, you get to be a part of it. Tom Sharpling also works as a writer for TV shows. He wrote on Monk, he writes on What We Do in the Shadows. He's been a cartoon voice actor, a music video director, and most recently, a best-selling author. Today, Tom Sharpling joins me to talk about his recent memoir, It Never Ends, and the way music and that desire to be in on something, whether it's a joke or a band, has shaped his life. That conversation is coming up. But first, a song from a frequent Best Show caller and a friend of Tom's who mentions him in this song. It's Kurt Vile, joined by Courtney Barnett with Blue Cheese.
So kiss me with your mouth once more. Girl in real life. The cheer of Tom Sharpling.
You might have caught my guest today name-checked in that song you just heard, Blue Cheese, from Kurt Vile and Courtney Barnett. They mention Tom Sharpling, and I'm so excited to have Tom Sharpling right here with me right now. Tom, welcome to the World Cafe.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is so exciting for me, too, you know.
It's very, very exciting. I want to say first, congratulations on your new book, It Never Ends, a memoir with nice memories. I read it in one day. And I can't remember the last book that I did that with. Like, I sat down and I didn't put it down until I was done.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. People say that, and it makes me wonder if I wrote a really simple book then. When people are like, I read it so fast. And I'm like, I haven't read a book that fast since The Cat in the Hat. And then I'm like, oh boy, maybe I wrote a children's book. I don't know.
But the large print version.
Yes. Thank you.
No, I mean, it's a super engaging story. And it opens with a story that I know you've told many times on your own show, on The Best Show. I'm going to ask you if you can tell it one more time for folks here who maybe haven't heard it. Could you give us a recap of your interaction with Patti Smith?
Yeah. Let me get ready to stab myself one more time with the... No, it's fine. I was in San Francisco. And for San Francisco Sketch Fest, so I was put up at this hotel for a few days, and I kept running into Patti Smith over and over, seeing her in the lobby, seeing her walking around, and it started to feel more and more like a sign, like, oh, I gotta say something to Patti Smith. And then finally, I see her get into an elevator, and I'm with my friend and comedy partner, John Worster, and I'm like, I'm gonna go in and say something to her. And I go in the elevator, and I know this, I was not stalking her or anything. It's just, it's all in the hotel lobby. So I just wanted to say one thing, and because she's such a icon and hero, but I was also like, I'm not going to say the usual thing that people say, because people just, I'm not going to say, I like your albums or anything like that. So I was like, What's something she's never heard that's going to make her just feel like, oh, this is interesting? So I think back to this cab driver in Memphis who told me that Humble Pie was the best band he ever saw live. And he saw all the greats in the 70s. And so I said to Patti Smith, how are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And then it was very cordial, very nice. And then I say, so did you ever see Humble Pie back in the day? And as soon as I said it, I knew it was the wrong thing to say, and she did not look interested and looked like she wanted to just get off the elevator. And I think she might have gotten off at a floor that wasn't even her floor because she wanted to get away from the weird guy asking about seeing Humble Pie. And then the elevator went back down to the lobby, and then John saw me and he's like, how'd it go? And then I was like, I told him, and then I think he thought that the story would die with us in that moment, but then I could not resist and started talking about it on the radio, and now it is what I am known for.
I feel like it's an impossible... There were a couple of things that struck me about that story. One was that I feel like it's an impossible quest, kind of, when you want to say something to someone you admire, that they're going to be like, you understand me. This is a different interaction than the millions that I've had already. And it's like such a hard thing to decide what you're actually going to say to that person.
Yeah, and it's better to maybe not, now I realize, to maybe not manufacture something that is just meant to only be interesting in an arcane way. Might be better if I don't have anything interesting to say to not say anything.
You know, I know you've told that story on the show, but if you're writing a memoir, I would imagine figuring out where to start would be one of the trickiest parts. Why was that story the right place?
It seemed like one of the hits that I could play early to get the crowd on my side, and maybe, and for people who didn't know who I was, if they were checking the book out, then they would be maybe they would be compelled to keep going, because it's I know it's definitely a crowd pleaser, and I see the looks on people's faces when they mention Patti Smith to me. Now I'm getting it from both sides. I struck out when I said something to Patti Smith, and now people throw the Patti Smith story in my face just to see what happens. But at this point, it's just I accept it. It happened. It did not go well. And some people are like, maybe you should get in touch with Patti Smith and see how that goes. Like, no, I don't want to. Why would I keep this going?
Yeah, doubling down feels like the wrong choice at that point.
Yeah. Then you're the person at the casino who's just like asking the pit boss for just $5,000 more. And then you're just like good money after bad.
Yeah, I think there was something about that. As an interviewer on the radio, I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of people that I really admire. And one time, you know, I did have a terrible interview with an artist I really liked, and I couldn't listen to that artist for a while after that. It was like too cringy. Are you able to listen to Patti Smith now? Like, I'm sure at this point you're probably okay, but did it take a while so you could like put on a Patti Smith album and be like, oh, I don't feel weird?
No, I was always fine with it, because this is 100% my fault. This is not, it's not like, oh, I saw Patti Smith and she was such a jerk to me. It's just like, this had nothing to do with her. It just made me maybe not want to look in the mirror and see that guy looking back rather than listen to Patti Smith.
Well, in that case, could you pick a Patti Smith song for us and we can play it right now?
Sure. Ask the Angels, maybe, right? Is that good?
Ask the Angels?
Sure.
Here is Patti Smith, Ask the Angels. That was Patti Smith with Ask the Angels on World Cafe, chosen by my guest today, Tom Sharpling, comedian, television writer, producer, music video director. I got that off the back of your book in that exact order.
Perfect.
Co-founder and host of The Best Show, also co-host of the great podcast Double Threat, and now author, new memoir called It Never Ends. Obviously, a big part of your memoir revolves around The Best Show, which you hosted on WFMU for 13 years. You now host it on your own podcast network. It's grown a real dedicated fan base, myself included. But if you were going to talk to somebody who had never heard of Newbridge, who had never heard of The Best Show, how might you describe it?
That's a really good question. I guess I would say it's a call-in show that I host, that we do different topics and things, and But I also have a comedy partner where he calls in, John Worster, and we do these calls where he's the any variety of crazy characters calling in, and I kind of have a conversation with crazy people like that. And it all, there's a fictional town we created called Newbridge, which kind of is the hub of everything, and it's a kind of a catch-all town in New Jersey that can allow any dumb comedy premise to exist.
So when you first got your time slot on WFMU, you were doing an overnight show. It was just you, and that was your first time on the radio. This didn't exist yet, the best show. What did you think walking into the studio that first night your show was going to be?
Oh, well, that was just the first time doing radio was such a huge thing for me because it was something I was so obsessed by and so held on such a high pedestal, and to get to be on the other side of it, not the side listening to it, but the side making the radio, was I really, not to be overly dramatic, I felt it was a real sense of it was like there was a burden of doing it right that I took shockingly seriously for doing an overnight show. And I kind of always still feel that way. Even if I get comfortable doing it, I still feel it's my time and it's the listener's time. And if we're going to do it, it's like, let's make it count and try to do something maybe that people don't expect, or put two things together that shouldn't fit together and see what happens. You want to do something with the form while doing it so that you can kind of advance it and give people a reason to want to keep listening. And I still feel that way.
One thing I noticed the first time I heard you, I mean, I heard you for the first time on The Best Show, not on those early broadcasts on WFMU that you did by yourself.
Nobody heard those. Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I was struck by, I remember listening to the first time I heard The Best Show, I thought for a minute that like the phone had died because you were silent for a while, and I had, mm-hmm. you never hear radio hosts use that silence that way. And as a broadcaster myself, and I started in commercial radio where it's like, go, 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 go. Learning to use that is a really powerful thing. Like, how long did it take you to figure that out?
The whole thing with the silence on the radio and starting to use that and try to not be scared of it and actually lean into it was something that it felt like something that was worth playing with, because it's the scariest thing in a way to have silence on the radio. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, it usually means something's wrong. Like you said, it's like, did something happen to my radio? What's going on here? Is my internet dead? No, but there's something about just controlling the pace of some of what you're saying, and really just kind of force people to lean forward and stay with you, because so much of radio has been nothing but just like an assault on you, like audio assault, where if you listen to commercial radio, there's not a dead spot anywhere in there. And I just like the idea of stretching it out, because then when it gets loud or crazy, then it really seems loud and crazy because we slowed it down so much.
Yeah, people lean in. Aside from the talking on air, what kind of music were you playing on those first few shows? Do you remember the first song you played on air? Because I would imagine that first playlist you probably put together pretty meticulously.
Oh my God, I would just... If you'd think I was designing like a space shuttle or something, the way I would work on those playlists and be like, no, this song must go into this song. And it's like, I think I remember that first night, I know at one point in the show I played a Sandy Bull song that was so long, but it's a really good instrumental classical folk psych record that I really liked. And I remember playing that and then working that into a something by a guy named John Davis, who was known as the other half of the folk implosion with Lou Barlow. So that was, I remember that being a mix I was particularly proud of. And I just remember thinking I had kind of cured polio when I came up with that one.
I'm going to see if we can find the, did you say it was Sandy Bowl?
Oh, you don't want it. It's 20 minutes long.
We can just play a bit.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. I can tell you which one it is. Let me see. Well, yeah, the name of the record was E Pluribus Unum from 1968. I think I played Electric Blend.
So that was a bit of Sandy Bowl, Electric Blend. That was one of the first songs Tom Sharpling played on the radio when he first got his show on WFMU. You have, you know, you've been a Superchunk fan for a long time. One of their shows, I know back when you were doing radio early on, it ended up being a really life-changing event. You met your comedy partner, John Worster, who was drumming for Superchunk at the time. When you met John at this show, how did you know that it was something special?
That was a crazy night. That was Superchunk. It was at the Ritz and in New York City. And the bill was literally Superchunk, Pavement, My Bloody Valentine. And it was one of those ones where you're just like, man, you look back, you're like, oh my God, all three bands on one bill? How'd that happen? Yeah, that, because I was already a fan of Superchunks, and I was a friend with the band, and Mac McCon, the front man for Superchunk, told me on the phone before the show, oh, we have a new drummer, his name is John, I think you're going to like him. And I was kind of bummed, because I was like, oh, I like Chuck, the previous drummer, and it's so, but then I saw them play, and John is just one of the best drummers ever, just totally propulsive and exciting and does his own thing. So it's just like, wow, okay, this guy's ramping the band up to a different gear. So I was excited already. And then we hung out backstage and started talking, and it became some version of that game where you kind of feel the other person out and you're seeing what references they know or don't know to see how deep this is going to be between us. And we're just like, well, did you ever see this movie, The Dresser, an Albert Finney movie? It's like, yeah. So did you ever see Real Life, Albert Brooks? It's like, yeah, yeah. So we're just, you're going level to level. And then Get a Life is one of the big ones for me, the Chris Elliott sitcom from the early 90s, because it's one of those shows that some people hated so much that it was always like a sign. It's like if somebody hated it so much, you're kind of like, eh, I don't know if this is gonna work between us. But John loved it. And then the biggest challenge of all was like the ace that either of us would, and it turned out, would throw down on other people, because he was doing the same thing to people he would meet, seeing how, what they were into. There was this VJ on MTV for one summer named Smash, who was like one of those classic grizzled radio vets who knows, they gave him a gig on MTV over a summer and he kind of didn't fit in. He was just, looked like twice the age of everybody there. So it's just, he stuck out like a sore thumb, because it was like suddenly dad showed up on MTV talking all about Fog Hat, and kids are at home watching. They're like, why is my uncle a VJ all of a sudden? So he interviewed Guns N' Roses one time, very early for Guns N' Roses, and then Guns N' Roses trashed the studio, and it was kind of a funny, weird, dumb thing to be obsessed with this guy Smash. But I knew Smash and John knew Smash, and then we have never been apart since then.
I Googled Smash, and he's like been erased from history. I found one article about him.
Yes, I have gone on a Smash hunt. I think he's still out there. I think he's maybe a Texas DJ or something. He's definitely a pre-internet guy. So, yeah. Not a whole lot of Smash info over on Wikipedia.
I mean, one thing that I really loved reading about when it came to your relationship with John was that you would spend so much time talking on the phone.
Yeah.
And which is something that I feel like now people don't do anymore.
Sure. Like if you got a phone call from a friend, you saw the light up and they're calling you, you'd be just like, oh no, what's wrong? Yeah. What's happening now? No, but back then it would just be like, hey, what's up? What are you doing? And then, or just starting with a bit, pretending to be somebody. We were doing the Best Show stuff off air all the time. We would just jump right into character stuff and work it out over the phone for hours. And then we would kind of cull through that and take the best of it and put it on and do it on the show. But it was my favorite thing. I feel like that is a lost pleasure in this era that a lot of kids might not realize. It's a lot of fun to just talk to people on the phone and sit on a couch and find yourself watching TV with your friend over the phone when they're watching the same show you're watching. Like those things were really important to me, and I didn't realize how important they were. Just the idea of just spend 2 hours on the phone with your friend and with whatever Seinfeld is on in the background, and you're just talking about the show, and then you're talking about other stuff, then you talk about the show a little more. Yeah, it was a really nice way to kind of burn a day or a night.
I think that brings us nicely to the way I found out about Best Show, and I think a lot of people did, was from hearing Rock, Rot, and Rule, which you did before the Best Show officially existed, where you hosted and John called in as a guy called Ronald Thomas Klontel, who had written this book that basically says, which, by the way, Ronald Thomas Klontel, I think, might be my favorite fictional name of all time. Like, it's just so fun to say. It sounds so silly immediately. It's perfect.
Thank you. No, those are my favorite ones. The names that are just slightly trippy when you get them coming out of your mouth. There's like a couple hurdles to jump when you say them. And that somebody would choose, if your name was Ronald Klontel, which that you would choose to put the Thomas in there. It's like you're not, I don't know if you need to differentiate from another Ronald Klontel.
Yeah, you could have gone by Ron.
Ron Klontel. Be so easy to say, but to have to embrace the Ronald and then throw Thomas in there also.
So you have Ronald Thomas Klontel. He's written this book, which basically says whether bands rock, rot, or rule. You go through and name bands, and he says what category they should fall into. So, you know, Queen rules. Bruce Hornsby rules, but he doesn't rock because he doesn't play guitar. The Beatles rock. David Bowie rots. And it, of course, you know, feels very arbitrary and ridiculous. And then actual WFMU listeners start calling in because they think this book is real. I'm going to play a little bit of a clip from that.
The intrinsic problem I have with this argument is that you're imposing these values upon the rest of the society and as like the ultimate deciding factor.
See, then this is where I'm going to probably have to say we get this argument with WFMU a lot.
Right.
Is that if you don't like it, you can just turn it off and
of course
go up the dial and see if there's something else you're interested. If you're not interested in this, I guess you could buy another rock book.
But WFMU doesn't proclaim to be like the know-it-all of all music.
So that is an actual WFMU listener calling in to talk to Ronald Thomas Klontel on Rock, Rot, and Rule. You must have known that you were going to get some strong reactions. So what kind of reaction were you guys expecting from listeners?
Well, it's funny because at that point, since we had not really done anything like this and it was uncharted territory, and I don't think we thought we were going to take calls that night necessarily, but the phones all lit up with people who couldn't handle the idea that this moron, I think the thing that gets people ultimately is not that a moron had bad opinions, but it was that a moron that had bad opinions sold a book, and that's right. What drove people crazy. It's just like, oh no, this this dope is now going to get to be an authority on this just because they managed to sell it as a book, and I know better, but I cannot let this stand and let them be the authority. So they called up and started straight up arguing.
The way that Rock, Rotten Rule spread around, I'm going to use myself as an example. So my boyfriend played it for me years and years ago. And then I eventually ended up making my entire immediate family listen to the whole thing around the campfire.
Around the campfire.
Exciting. On a portable speaker. And I feel like that kind of is how Rock, Rotten Rule spread. Like, people would just show it to each other. You made cassettes. It became this cult thing. How did you realize it was taking on a life of its own?
The weirdest one was that on an episode of Strangers with Candy, there's so many classroom scenes, and there's a chalkboard in the background of one scene with Stephen Colbert, and someone wrote a reference to Rock, Rotten Rule on the chalkboard, and we were like, oh my God, how did they find out about this thing? It's just, we just did this dumb thing, and now this show that we love made a reference to us, and we're just like, how? I don't know. It was just such a, like, little things like that were very, were telling that it was just getting around, because there was no way to gauge it, because it was still people passing cassettes around, but you could kind of feel some low level awareness of it. And once in a while, I'd see somebody at a show, and then they would say some line from it, and I'd be like, yeah, okay. And I'd be like, wait, oh, no, that's from the thing I did. Like, I would be confused. I'd be like, they would say something about, oh, I don't like comedy and music or whatever. And I'd be like, oh, okay, well, good for you, I guess. And then I'd be like, oh, okay, that's, they're making a reference to Rock, Rotten Rule. And that's what made us want to keep doing more of this, because it felt like we were tapping into something that there was nobody doing long form character stuff at that point. There just really wasn't. I just now with podcasting and stuff, it's opened it up that people can do any version of anything. I think it's fantastic, but I know we were out on a ledge on that one in terms of the form.
Yeah, because I think people would imagine that doing that on a radio station, you'd have to deal with a whole bunch of constraints. But WFMU, you were really kind of able to go for it.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about WFMU is if you get a show, then that means they trust you with the airtime, that you're going to do something with it. So then the next thing is to go do something with it. And we didn't have somebody breathing down our neck saying, like, I like this, I don't like that, do more of this, do less of that, that was too long. We were able to really spread out and do our thing in the version and the way we wanted to, which is just so important to not have somebody kind of clipping your wings when you're just starting out. And we could not have done any of this stuff if WFMU was not so generous.
I'm speaking with Tom Sharpling on World Cafe. Cassette trading and that kind of finding and sharing music, or in that case, comedy, was something that you always kind of seemed to be into. Even before being on WFMU, you had a zine, 18 Wheeler, you had a label, you traded cassettes all the time. As a kid growing up in New Jersey, where did that interest in independent music and that sort of underground scene come from?
So much of my interest in underground music and whatever the culture was that was below the mainstream culture, so much of that was introduced to me through college radio. And it just became clear that whether it was WFMU, which was at when it started off was a part of a college called Uppsala College that went under, but the station became a kind of a self-reliant entity because they bought their own license, which was a kind of a master stroke. WFMU, Princeton Station, WPRB, Rutgers College, WRSU, they were all, I was in the middle of all three of those and could hear three really good college radio stations. And it just, you realize there's another world out there because it's like, it really just feels like a parallel universe. After a lifetime of listening to just professional radio, hearing people doing stuff that was less professional but clearly more personal, was it meant so much to me, both as the music they were playing and the people doing the broadcasts. Like, I saw there were two parts that felt eye-opening there.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and you would have been growing up in New Jersey at like the peak of Springsteen, right?
Oh yeah. Oh my god.
So that
god,
you'd be
no.
surrounded by that.
And I love Bruce Springsteen, but at that point I did not, because I can't express the degree with when Born in the USA was out, the amount of Bruce Springsteen that was in everyone's face in New Jersey at that point. I can't imagine how somebody could still want more of it. Like, at that point, you were just getting it, like, you're just getting it jammed in your face. And he would play these runs at Giants Stadium. And I mean, I remember one time going past a record store, and the way tickets used to go on, become available, would they go at like record stores had ticket machines and kids would line up. I remember there was like Bruce Springsteen tickets going on sale, and I went past and this guy ran out and he's like, I got four seats. He was like yelling to everybody, I got four seats. And like, It was like that was like gold then, though, because Bruce Springsteen was like the economy of New Jersey. And I was just like, man, I don't like this guy. This guy sucks. Even though I still did like him, I just didn't have any room for it. So I actively started to try to find other things. It's like, no, I like Husker Du now. I don't like this guy. That's what I want to hear more of. And then that just like, it felt like if you didn't need an alternative to the amount of that you were getting, I don't know what to say. I don't know. It would be just like eating just like peanut butter all the time. Just imagine if like the only food is just peanut butter.
And you and want like, more.
And then you're like, I want more peanut butter. You're just like, give me more and just peanut butter. You'd be like, no, it's going to kill me. But yeah, that was being in New Jersey in the 80s.
You wrote in the book about how seeing REM play at Rutgers when you were, I think, 13, mm-hmm. was a life-changing event. What was it about that show?
It was REM, I think Murmur was either out or was about to come out. And I had heard about them in Rolling Stone, and then I would hear them on whatever those college radio stations would play REM. And so I went to Rutgers, and the REM was basically playing the food court there at night in one of the student centers. And Let's Active opened, and they made this huge impression on me. They were so good. And then REM were just perfect. They were so mysterious. At that point, you just didn't know what the deal with Michael Stipe was, because he was just in full mumble mode. Everything was kind of said like a fractured statements, and everything was just a question mark. But the music was just amazing, And I loved the mystery with it. They were, that was just truly, and also because they were young and they were doing this thing that felt like it was going to be a thing. And then they kept getting more popular each time they put an album out. And you're like, I picked the right band. They're getting better.
You picked the right team to be a fan of. Yeah. Well,
exactly.
let's hear some Radio Free Europe, REM, on World Cafe. REM, Radio Free Europe. It's World Cafe. I'm Raina Duras talking with Tom Sharpling today. He has a new book out called It Never Ends. One thing you noted in your book that I found relatable is this desire to be close to the music and involved with it, but not the desire to make it yourself, to not get on stage and play. There is one exception to that in your book when you do attempt to be part of a band. And you auditioned for the New Monkees in 1986, which did not really go great. What was that experience like?
Well, that was a troubling time in little Tom's life back then. In all seriousness, I had come out of a pretty severe run of mental health issues that were very extreme. And I more or less, I was rebuilding my life as an 18-year-old, and the Monkees meant so much to me, and they were kind of helping me feel whole and feel normal. And then suddenly MTV runs some thing saying, come audition for the new Monkees. And who knows, whatever that voice in me was just like, go try. I could barely play bass guitar back then. So naturally, being in New Jersey, I get on the New Jersey Transit, take the train in with a very heavy bass guitar. So heavy. Oh my God. It was made, I don't know what wood this was made out of, but they should make cars out of it, because it was like, this was the most dense substance I've ever felt, and naturally that's the one I'm lugging around. And then I just line up and I go into this thing and it's over in like 45 seconds, because I'm just like a weird kid, 18-year-old with no discernible talent. I don't know what I thought they were gonna say, like, no, let's go deeper with this kid. On the surface he looks talentless. I believe there's something there. Let's put this kid through fame school or whatever they were going to do to pull out the real me. I don't know what I thought I would have even done. If they said yes, it would have been the most terrifying day of my life.
Like, imagine what your life would have been like as a member of the New Monkees.
Could you imagine that? Have that? Then I'd be scrubbing that from the internet. I'd be just like trying to have it like, I don't know. I just would. Well, I'd be a different person, I guess, if I could have gotten through, because then I would have been like a pro musician who also seems like they could be funny on camera. I don't know. It was as wrong could be. And they were 100% justified to smile at me and then say, thanks for coming by. And I don't even think they said, we'll let you know, because I think we both knew at that moment, you're not New Monkees material, Tom.
I do want to talk about your love of the Monkees for a second before we hear a song by the Monkees, because I think a lot of, like, quote unquote, serious music fans don't take the Monkees super seriously. You know, I think that they're a band that kind of get overlooked. And while I was reading your chapters about the Monkees in the book, I listened to the soundtrack to the movie Head, and I was like, this rocks. But what is it that you love? Like, I want you to choose a song from Head, first of all, to play and tell us what you love about the Monkees so much.
Sure. Well, we can do As We Go Along is a great song. Yeah, I mean, the Monkees, to me, of course, they were not a quote-unquote real band, but that was such a relatively new concept at that point anyway. The idea of authenticity being some immovable metric in art is such a, I don't know, it just feels like such a limiting concept, because in the big picture, it's like, I mean, is Bob Dylan authentic? I mean, he was not a folky, really. He's just a goofball from Minnesota. He was not Woody Guthrie, but it's like, and he was, you know, Robert Zimmerman. It's like, what is authenticity? It's like everybody's favorite people usually have some inauthentic performative streak in their thing for it to be what it is. It's like Led Zeppelin are not Delta blues men. That's, they're pretending. They're taking it and completely pretending that that's who they are. But I just feel like the Monkees, they're undeniable comedic performers on the show. They were able to hold their own hosting a sitcom, basically. But musically, it's like Mickey Dolenz has one of the all-time great rock voices. Just undeniably perfect rock voice. Michael Nesmith is an amazing songwriter. Whatever that was, it added up to something. And they were also given just the best songs you could have. They had the most amazing songwriters. They had access to Nilsson and Neil Diamond and Carole King, and they just, and you know, Boyce and Hart. And it's so strange that something so corporate could have created so many perfect musical moments that I would put against anybody's musical moments.
We're going to hear As We Go Along from Head, from the Monkees right now. Why did you choose this one?
It's like I said about Mickey Dolenz's voice, that's a perfect showcase for him, and just shows the singer, like, he brought that to pop radio, and he was also the star of a TV show at the same time. It's really a pretty impossible thing that they pulled off for the few years that they were on top of the world.
Monkees on World Cafe. I'm Raina Duris talking to Tom Sharpling today. Monkees blended comedy and music. You blend comedy and music. You have your whole career. Why are comedy and music so often linked?
I guess they both draw very extreme reactions from people, that comedy makes you laugh, and that's such a physical, undeniable experience, and music just moves you in so many different ways. I think they're both very powerful means of connecting with people. And I don't know if that says about me, that I need as much of that as I can get. So those are my two favorite things, and they always were, and they always have been. It's funny that it really did. My thing sorted itself out very early in that regard, that I was just like, I like comedy, I'm obsessed with that. I like music, I'm obsessed with that. And it more or less has stayed that way the whole time.
And I mean, people who are listening may not even realize that they've seen your work with some of their favorite bands' music videos, New Pornographers, Amy Mann, you've done videos for a few people. And there are a few ideas in the book that you talk about that haven't gotten made that are very funny, like the idea to film a funeral for an artist and have their real friends and family mourn them, or the video that you pitched to Paul Simon's people, which I think is a real laugh out loud moment, if you'd like to let people know what that is, because I'm hoping it gets made at some point.
Oh, it won't. I can kind of spoil that one for you right now, Raina. It's no, I had gotten a chance to pitch video ideas for Paul Simon, and so I wrote up this one idea that was basically at that point. OK Go were the kings of videos, and they had all these high concept, impossible, amazing videos that were very like stunt oriented, or
like the treadmill one.
The treadmill one, or the one I was thinking of was for what's this song called? This Too Shall Pass, I think it's called, where it's like a giant Rube Goldberg thing in it, taking over an entire warehouse. It's one of the most impressive things I've ever seen of anything ever. But I was like, well, what if Paul Simon's in one like that? And then just this oil drum rolls off target by accident and just hits him in the leg and severely hurts him. And then he doubles over and hits the ground. And then it's just a one single shot of people realizing Paul Simon's seriously hurt. And then he gets put into an ambulance. And then the camera would follow him in the ambulance. And then it's just the video ends when the song ends. And needless to say, did not make that one.
See, but the thing that I really love about the way that you present that in the book is it's an unqualified triumph. And it's sort of, there's sort of this theme throughout your memoir where it's like, as long as you get the joke, as long as you find it funny, as long as the people that you are, you know, as long as the joke works for you, it's worth it and it's good. And when I was reading the book, I really loved the story you tell about when you're walking down the boardwalk and you're wearing your King Crimson t-shirt and a guy points at it and says, "We get it." And that felt to me kind of like a thread that connects so many of the stories that you tell. It's like this being part of a group that gets it, that isn't quite in the mainstream, that maybe is like an underdog. Why did those things appeal to you so much? Was that even a theme that you had already picked up on before writing this, or did it kind of come out?
The whole idea of we get it,
yeah.
They don't. Because this guy on the boardwalk I think it was Seaside Heights, saw me in a King Crimson t-shirt, and he was like, "Hey, King Crimson." I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "We get it." And then like he points derisively at the other sheep on the boardwalk. He's like, "They don't." And I almost called the book "We Get It, They Don't," but it just feels like I've spent this life of being interested in different things people make and then getting to make things that thankfully people have been interested in. And if somebody doesn't get it, then I don't know what to say about that. I can explain parts and see if they get more, the references help them get it. But if they don't, they don't. It's okay. There's things that they might be into that I have no entry point on also.
Well, to finish things off, in honor of that story, I was wondering if you could pick, because I'm always excited for an excuse to play King Crimson on Roll Cafe, and I know they're one of your favorite bands. Could you choose a song from King Crimson to end this interview?
How long of a song can we pick?
You know what? You can choose it to be as long as you want, but we may have to cut it anyway.
You might have to fade down.
Yeah.
Well, let's go with Starless then, is always the way to go with them. And you pick where when you've had enough Starless.
Tom Sharpling is my guest today on World Cafe. We've been talking about his new memoir, It Never Ends. It's out now. I highly recommend you go read it. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. This was such a treat. It's such a good time.
This is Starless from King Crimson.
Cruel, twisted smile, and the smile signals emptiness for me. Star is
King Crimson, Starless. Well, a bit of it. It keeps going for about 10 more glorious minutes. That song was chosen by my guest today, Tom Sharpling. His new book is out now, his memoir. It's called It Never Ends. Thanks again to Tom. That was so much fun. And thank you for listening. I'm Rena Duris. This has been World Cafe.